Yeah, but I'm rather going to do that there.
I don't have a secretary, neither a PA. So I'm running from one meeting to another without proper arrangement. Difficult, you know, that is. It's a too short analysis from a research away from the research units in Parliament with regard to the very same bill that you are dealing with. We did get a presentation last week from the department led by the minister, the deputy minister. And then we requested then the research units in Parliament to do some research within. Then you're going to take this summary from Patricia Whistle and also from Susan Isaac. So without any waste of time, Susan or Patricia, whoever will be starting, can we start with that briefing? Because we want to release members early in order for them to prepare themselves, those who will be going to Pretoria, because we'll be leaving this evening to Pretoria to the forensic labs, in order for us, when we deal with this bill, we know exactly what is it that we are talking about. Thanks very much. Up to you then.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Honourable Members, good morning. We thank you for the opportunity to just give some input on the forensics bill before you. As was mentioned, there has already been a presentation with a summary, and we've also made available to members a document entitled Summary of the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill and Analysis of Selected Clauses. But my presentation this morning is not intended to go through the document as a whole, but I'm just going to focus on what we believe are the main issues in the bill that we would like to bring to the attention of members. And the intention is to just highlight those issues so that it can be raised with the department. I was also requested just to bring to the members' attention that what we are going to put forward is from the research unit side. So it is from our interrogation of the bill that we came up with questions and issues that we want to bring to the members' attention, so that when the bill is dealt with, that those issues will then be in the forefront. If we can just go to the PowerPoint presentation that was handed out, entitled Summary of Main Issues for Consideration in the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill. That will be my presentation, and my colleague Sue Ann will then deal with the constitutional issues in the bill. Just to give a short idea of how the presentation is going to proceed, you will see on the contents page on page 2 is the introduction and just talking a little bit about the structure of the bill and selected definitions, and then looking at the new sections that are inserted in the Criminal Procedure Act by the bill, and the amendment to Section 37 of the Criminal Procedure Act, and then the other main acts that are being amended by the bill will be the South African Police Service Act and the Firearms Control Act and the Explosives Act. Just by way of introduction, we've heard also last week when the department presented, and if you look at the poll, the situation that is currently is that the Criminal Procedure Act only regulates taking of blood samples and in criminal cases and the ascertainment of other bodily features. And the police only have access to its own database, which stores a limited number of fingerprints of convicted persons. So the main thing that the bill wants to achieve is to expand the powers of the police to collect and store DNA samples and fingerprints, to establish and administer a national DNA database, to give the police access to the electronic databases of the Department of Home Affairs and the Department of Transport. And then also at the same time, in order to bring those changes about, it has to fix certain amendments to the Criminal Procedure Act, the SAS Act, the Firearms Control Act, and the Explosive Act. If you look at page 4 of the presentation, where it speaks about the presentation of the summary of the key issues in the bill will be discussed for consideration, and as I mentioned, the constitutional issues will be dealt with separately. Just Also, I would like to point out the preamble of the bill sets out the objectives, and then clause 2, which inserts a new clause into the Criminal Procedure Act, is actually the definitions clause, where the new terminology that that we find in the bill and that will be inserted into these various acts are now being introduced to us. And I just want to draw attention to, in particular, the bill makes a distinction when it talks about DNA samples. It talks about intimate samples and non-intimate samples. So those are two important distinctions. And the other thing that I also want to point out is the bill also speaks about DNA samples and DNA profiles. So those are also two important distinctions, because later on in the bill, when you speak about retention of samples, that two distinctions will be very important indeed. And then obviously the bill then speaks about the storage and the use of fingerprints, body prints, and photographic images of persons. Who may deal with it, and obviously the different the national instructions and the regulations that will be issued at a later stage, which will regulate the manner in which the samples and the fingerprints and the photographic images will have to be dealt with. Other things that are dealt with in the bill, that standards must be set for quality assurance for forensic science laboratories and for the analysis of samples, and then obviously standards with regard to the retention, storage, and destruction of samples and DNA profiles. Then last week the Deputy Minister also introduced us to the various indices that the bill establishes, just to mention a crime scene index, the reference index. What I will also focus on a little bit later in the presentation is particularly the volunteer index and the personnel contractor and supplier eliminator index. And then lastly, we have offenses and penalties for when the intention of the bill is that the use of those DNA samples, if they're used for any other purpose, then the bill introduces penalties and imprisonment for up to 15 years where that is not complied with. And then the last part of the bill, clauses 7 to 10, are the consequential amendments that are made to the Explosives Act and the Firearms Control Act. Now, on page 6 of your slides, you will see the heading says key issues. And on this, I'm not going to deal with all of these in detail because some of them, some of the issues will be dealt with in the comparative analysis after this. But just to mention, I spoke about earlier that the extension of the power of the police to collect, store, and destroy DNA and fingerprint evidence. And when we speak about DNA, I mentioned earlier there is a distinction between intimate and non-intimate samples. And then also looking at the scope of the bill in respect of to which persons the bill will be applicable to. And what is important to note in this bill is that before the amendment was made to the Criminal Procedure Act, it referred to accused persons. What the bill now does is to make this requirement applicable to all persons. And last week there was also issue raised with regard to children, and you will see in the bill that children are defined as persons under 18. And later on in the bill you will read that as for the purpose of the bill, a reference to persons also is a reference to children. So that is a very important issue to take note of in the bill. And the issue of children, I just want to mention here, we have in place at the moment the Child Justice Bill, and that bill will very soon take precedence in criminal matters where children are concerned. And there was a concern raised about why the bill is applicable to children. And last week, the Deputy Minister really placed a lot of emphasis on safeguards. And I think it's important that we mentioned that we need to look at the bill and see if there are areas with regard to safeguards where that can be tightened up and built into the bill. And I think this is an important area where we can where the committee can look at safeguards to ensure that the rights of children are protected and that the provisions of the Child Justice Bill, for instance, which wants to provide that children are treated differently from adults, that comes through in the bill. The bill makes a concession, for instance, where parents have given consent. If you look at the voluntary index, where people can volunteer information of their DNA or the children's DNA, it says that that child, when it becomes 18 or older, can then approach the database to have that information removed. And the issue or the question here is, shouldn't that be an automatic provision? Because there's one, it is doubtful whether the child would actually know that the parents have made that information available for to be stored. But it should be looked at making that automatic provision for when the child reaches majority, that information then be removed from the database. And then looking at the purpose for which the DNA and fingerprint evidence can be used, the bill mentions the detection of a crime for investigation purposes, for prosecution purposes, and then other two areas that was also mentioned was to identify missing persons and to identify the remains where a body is not able to be identified. We have noted that the draft bill, before it was introduced to Parliament, had a provision about the prevention of crime, and we don't see that in the bill before the committee. So this is the question on why the aspect of prevention of crime doesn't come through in the bill, or what was the particular reason why that provision was removed. And then the issues that will also be raised in the comparative presentation that Anne will be doing, she's going to look at the purpose for which DNA and fingerprint evidence can be used, as well as the retention of samples and profiles of unconvicted persons and the issue of consent. Where we have a voluntary index, people volunteer the information, but at the same time the bill says that once that consent is given, you cannot withdraw it. So the question is, why have a voluntary index and not be able to withdraw that consent? And so this applies to children and adults whose information is stored. I'm going to move on to page 7, just looking at some of the definitions under clause 2 of the bill. Clause 2 inserts section 36A, which is a new clause into the Criminal Procedure Act. And I'm looking at one provision, section 36A1A, referring to an authorized person. Means in reference to one, photographic images, fingerprints or body prints, any police official in the performance of his or her official duties, or two, the NDDSA, meaning the National Database of South Africa, the police officer commanding the division, criminal record and forensic science service within the South African Police Service or his or her delegate. That earlier on I spoke about the application or the scope of the bill, and the use or reference to any police official is possibly problematic, because if we talk about safeguards that have to be built into the bill, we're looking at a sample or a piece of evidence that there's a possibility that it can be contaminated, in which case it could have serious repercussions. And to have any police official being competent to take that sample, to handle it, to store it, the bill doesn't differentiate between who handles, who stores, who transports. So then there has to be clearer definitions that come through in the bill regarding that. So our proposal is, when there is a reference to any police official, that the bill should state what competency level a certain police official should have, who collects the sample and who handles it. There must be some specification with regard to rank, experience, the training that is required, qualifications, etc. Then on page 8, continuing with the definitions, just an expansion, you will notice that the bill speaks about body prints. This term was not previously used in the Criminal Procedure Act. The Criminal Procedure Act specified from which part of the body prints could be taken, but now body prints is just a collective term which could mean prints from a person's ear, foot, nose, palm, or toes would be inclusive of that. And as I mentioned before, the children under 18, the bill applies to. And then the differences with regard to samples and profiles.
First of all, I've skimmed through the stuff, and basically it seems like we can read the stuff. It's stuff that's in the bill. And frankly, Chair, you know, this is our job. This is what we're supposed to do. It's the research department's job to give us more information. I see on the other side they've given us things like what is fingerprint, what is DNA. Those things are things that I think perhaps they should take us through. I'm just a bit worried that when we do give instructions to the research department, that they seem to assume that there are certain things that they can do which is beyond their scope. I'm looking particularly at the conclusion of this document. You know, when they conclude that, for example, the bill is one-sided and top-heavy and so on. Those are political decisions that political parties have to decide on. So I'm just suggesting that perhaps we can read this document and then perhaps they can take us to the stuff that we haven't heard about, which is the comparative study, the different countries, and perhaps some of the DNA scientific things that perhaps is going to add value.
Thanks very much, Honorable Fatim. I seem to be satisfied the way she's taking it through, because it's not all of us who understand it. But I think the way they do take it through, I'm satisfied with that. So I would like them to summarize and go through the way she is doing it. You may continue. Thanks for your concern.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to continue, I'm not going to labor some of the points, as I mentioned. The idea is just to highlight the important issues that we think is going to be important when the committee deliberates on the bill. It is no means intended to supersede the committee's powers. We're here to assist the committee, and that is what we're trying to do. The scope of the bill, we talked about the police official, and then on page 10 of the slides, I think what is just important to point out under persons, at the very last part of it, is the retrospective application of the bill. The bill applies to persons, whether they've been convicted or whether they're in prisons, and even parolees. And what it says is that the fingerprints and samples of those persons can be taken where it has not been done at the time of arrest. Now, why this issue is being raised is the concern about capacity, because it's an additional task that is being placed upon the police official. And if every person at the time of arrest must have his or her fingerprints taken, it's already an increase in the workload, because that sample will have to be dealt with afterwards. It will have to be analyzed once. That's an increase workload on the part of the forensics department. And then to have the bill also now apply retrospectively, it means that all persons already in the system who did not have his or her prints or samples taken at the time of arrest, that those persons will now also have to be dealt with. And the question is just, how does the department propose to deal with it? We actually thought about something that was positive in the sense of, if we talk about repeat offenders, for instance. When persons leave prison, there's no record of their fingerprints or the DNA, so it might be a deterrent where that is concerned. But at the same time, the concern is the capacity, because every sample that is taken must be sent for analysis. And the question is, how is the forensic science lab going to prioritize those samples? Because now you'll have on a daily basis new persons that are being arrested, plus you have persons whose samples were not taken previously. And then moving on to slide 11, we talk about the penalties if the information derived from the DNA samples are used for any other purpose. We just want to also, there's a provision in the bill that speaks about the retention of the samples and the destruction thereof after 5 years, especially with regard to persons who are not convicted. And last week, the Deputy Minister spoke about the fact that the department wanted that provision to indicate an indefinite retention of the samples, but then the state law advisors then inserted the 5-year period into the bill. And the question is just what informed the 5-year period? Maybe the department can just give more information around how that decision was derived at. And then with regard to consent, I mentioned earlier about the volunteer index. And the bill speaks about informed consent. And the issue that I would like to bring to the attention of the committee is we're dealing with a power relationship. And Sir Anne will also elaborate more about that. Where we have, on the whole, we have unsophisticated persons who may or may not know their rights. Normally in a power relationship, even where a person is aware that rights being requested by a police person to give information, usually the person complies. And this is also maybe an area where, when we're looking at building in safeguards, this is maybe a possible area where the committee can look into when we're talking about informed consent. Just on the issue of why we feel that the bill is biased in favor of the authorities. When you read through the bill, you'll see that the persons can be requested to provide samples and provide fingerprints. But the bill doesn't state under which circumstances they may or may not refuse to comply with that request. Because we're talking about not only convicted persons, but we're talking about unconvicted persons as well. So when we say bias, we're looking at what are the safeguards that can be built into the bill to address those. Because persons from whom samples and DNA fingerprints are requested, they have rights as well. And in certain acts, certainly they set out what those rights are. Now, there's a provision in the bill which states that even where the procedures were not properly followed, the evidence or the samples taken from the person is still admissible in court. And the question is, shouldn't that be a safeguard to say that if the proper procedure was not followed, then that evidence should not be admissible, or to make sure that the police and officials do follow the procedures, to make sure that the bill or all the good that we want to achieve with the bill is tight, you know, to make sure that we have something that works, but at the same time to protect the persons whose rights may be infringed by if the proper procedures, for instance, were not followed. And then at the same time, we're talking about, if you look on page 12 of the presentation, section 36 says a police official may, without a warrant, take fingerprints and samples from a person. And once again, the question is, isn't this an area where, by making a provision for a warrant in certain circumstances, that is an area where we can build a safeguard to make sure that it's not the power is not abused, that the provisions of the law is not abused. And then the issue of reasonable grounds, what the department can maybe set out circumstances where we could say those criteria were met and therefore there was reasonable grounds to suspect that a crime has been committed. Clause 3 of the bill on page 13 of the slides amend Section 37 of the Criminal Procedure Act, and it deals with the taking of body prints, photographic images, intimate and non-intimate samples. What is important to note here is when they speak about intimate samples, for the first time we have a reference to a medical practitioner or a registered nurse. What is also important, if you look at Section 37.2b, it actually shifts the responsibility of, when it comes to reasonable grounds, to the medical practitioner. Up to that point, it was the policeman who had to have the criteria of reasonable grounds that the crime was committed. But now, that shift is now on the medical practitioner. If there is a reasonable ground to believe that evidence, that DNA evidence, will be of value in an investigation, a criminal investigation. And the question is this a fair shift of responsibility? Because how would a medical practitioner know if it's not the district surgeon, for instance, dealing with a possible rape crime? How would that person be informed that that sample will be of value?
Just a moment. Can the lady just explain what she means by a shift? Because as I understand this clause, it comes from the criminal procedure as it stands. Now, what is being said here is that things are being changed. And I want to know what is being changed.
Can we note what we'd like to ask them? When,
but
give them,
you know, the problem is that we're being misled by this intent.
But I'm caring now, Fatima.
But
I'm saying that we listen. If you don't
order,
want to listen.
You must allow a point of order.
But I've ruled out on that thing. I said we must give her time. She's going to take us through, and then we note down everything, and then you can then accommodate your shift thing into the questions. But I'm not going to let her stop now and then we engage in the thing. I want her to finish. Let's give her time to finish. And then we can ask her those questions.
May I proceed?
Yes, ma'am.
The point of order is this. I have no problem with us taking an input and then you're opening up for questions, which is the normal procedure, which is what you're suggesting we do. The problem that I have is that the input is misleading on this point. Now, they are the research department. They are not an NGO coming to make their point, to elaborate and so on. At the very least, we should expect an honest bit of research. Now, that's my point of order. We shouldn't be engaging with our own research department in the way that we engage people in public hearings and so on, challenging them and so on. All I'm suggesting is that this is incorrect, what we're being told. And as the chair, I think you have a responsibility also to allow for these points of order, because it complicates our own work, because then we end up arguing about things that we shouldn't be arguing about, which is this stuff is supposed to help us. It's not supposed to mislead us and stuff like that. That's all I'm saying, Chair.
We've given them responsibility. We are not going to expect them to give us what they have researched and then we just keep quiet. We can't ask them questions. Definitely, we're going to ask them questions on the research that they've done for this community. We can't just take that research and then we fold our arms and say that everything that has been said is correct. When you have identified that here is a misleading point, then give them chance to go through that thing and then they must come back and respond to those things. Carry on.
Thank you, Chair. On page 13 still, on section 37.3a, where a court may order the ascertainment of bodily features and taking of intimate samples, in any case in which a police official is not empowered under subsection 1 or section 36b to take fingerprints, body prints, or a non-intimate sample, there's just a question of whether the department could possibly give examples of instances when a police official would not be empowered to take fingerprints, body prints, or a non-intimate sample. And then section 37.8, dealing with the destruction of print samples and information after 5 years where there's no conviction. The committee's attention is drawn to page 16 of the bill, section 15.02, the provision there is that the samples are destroyed, but the profiles are retained on the database. And the question is just, what is the rationale for saying that the samples can be destroyed, but then you still say in the bill that the profiles must be kept on the bill, on the database, it cannot be destroyed. On page 14, the other major act that's being amended is the South African Police Service Act. And what the bill does is inserts a new Chapter 5 in 5A and 5B into the SAS Act, which basically just deals with the, if I can look at the first point on page 14 of the slides, speculative searching for the cross-checking of prints and images on the SAS databases against the databases of other departments. And then just something on section 15C of that chapter, which speaks about the national instructions which must be tabled in Parliament. And then we know that the bill makes a distinction between the national instruction that must be tabled with regard to fingerprints, body prints, and photographic images. However, instructions dealing with those things, there's no imperative for the police to table those in Parliament. But the instructions dealing with the DNA evidence must be tabled in Parliament. And if you look on page 15 of the bill, section 15Q4, it says that it must be tabled within 3 months after the section commences. And just a question, maybe a comment, that what section is being referred to, because that is one section in a new chapter that is being inserted. So there should just be some clarity as to what is the time period commencement of what events or set of events department is referring to here. Then on page 15, if we look at, or if we recall the Deputy Minister's presentation last week, he said that it was not appropriate yet to have a complete separate unit to deal with DNA evidence and DNA analysis separate from SAS. And we know that in section 15C3 there is some leeway, I would say, to provide a certain level of independence and accountability from the SAS. And we're looking here at the particular responsibilities which can only be carried out by the divisional manager, divisional commissioner of the Criminal Record and Forensic Science Services. And the question is just that, is this provision sufficient if we look at the input with regard to independence and accountability in terms of management of the national DNA database? And there's a question also, there's a reference to the National Police Commissioner must develop, implement, and maintain a personal identification services strategy, as well as systems and processes to give effect to Chapters 5A and 5B. And there's a question on what is a personal identification services strategy. Then if you look at the following slide, I've mentioned some of the issues already earlier on. The only thing that I want to focus on is the third point under main issues under Chapter 5B, dealing with the elimination of suspects. And here specifically, the index that's been referred to is the Personnel, Contractors, and Suppliers Index. And there's just a concern, it appears as if there's an automatic exclusion or elimination of the DNA of those of that category of persons. The question is, what safeguards are in place to ensure that that where that one of those persons can be a suspect or can be a possible perpetrator? How is that going to be detected, for instance, in cases like that where person's details are already on the personnel, contractors and suppliers database. And then I've already spoken about the destruction of DNA samples and the period that it was mentioned before. There's just some things on page 17 of the slides. When we talk about what was the intention with regard to retaining samples and information or profiles on the ball, and just something that the committee may want to consider in the deliberation is the a scenario maybe, would it be feasible to have all profiles, once it is entered on the database, to remain there forever as the department has wanted at the beginning? Or should there only be the samples and profiles retained of persons who are convicted? And then what about the profiles of persons who are not convicted after a certain time period? Should they be retained at all, or should they be retained for a specified period only? And those are just some of the things for consideration. Then I will be finishing shortly, Madam Chair. And if I'm just looking on page 19 of the slides, just setting out the circumstances under which fingerprints and samples may be required for the Explosives Act and the Firearms Control Act. And if I look at the first part, the Firearms Control Act, basically, if you look at Chapter 4 of that Act, it sets out that when they apply or persons apply for competency certificates, license, permit, or authorization under the Act, and also when they're applying for cancellations or renewals of any of those documents, then that persons are required to submit a full set of fingerprints with the application. And then what this Act also then says is that that information is then stored on the Central Firearms Register, including the Central Firearms database. This section also refers to any police official who is competent to take samples and fingerprints from persons, provided that where bodily samples are taken, it's taken by a registered medical practitioner or a registered nurse. And the purpose for which those prints and fingerprints are used is also to determine whether a person suspected of having handled or discharged a firearm has indeed handled or discharged a firearm. Then just moving on to the Explosives Act, it's almost the same scenarios as in the Firearms Control Act. Then reasonable grounds where that a crime has been committed for investigation purposes. We have the same provision with regard to the medical practitioner and nurse, and also then to determine whether a person suspected of having handled or detonated an explosive has handled or detonated an explosive. And then just by way of conclusion, Madam Chair, I spoke earlier about the safeguards, and I just want to reiterate that there are opportunities maybe in the bill where greater safeguards can be built into the bill. And just to spell out that DNA evidence should not form the only basis on which a prosecution's case is built up, and that the proper detective and follow-up work and all the other constitutional and legislative requirements must be met, and that the DNA evidence should be used in support of the prosecution's case only. And then the point that I mentioned earlier with regard to retention of samples and profiles, that the committee needs to maybe consider the periods and to whom, which persons that would apply. And then a member pointed out last week, if you look on page 20 of the slide, it's the last point there, that we can have the best legislation in place, but the owners are still going to be on SAPs to make sure that the proper training and expertise from their members are in place. The persons who receive the reports that a crime has been committed, the detectives who arrive first on the scene, the forensic analyst capacity, that those things are in place. We've heard many times during budget hearings, and last year was no exception, and the Deputy Minister also pointed out that SAPS has a problem with capacity as far as forensic experts are concerned. And the question is this now, is SAFS really in a position now to be able to deliver in terms of what the bill wants to achieve? And then the department could possibly provide more information to the committee about the costing. The costing document would be presented to the committee, as well as the implementation plan and clear time frames for rollout. I spoke earlier about why we feel that the bill is not biased, is biased, and that there are areas where this can be improved to make provision for the rights of individuals. And then there should be greater consideration given to points that were raised about constitutional implications, and Anne will deal with that in the paper now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. You are Patricia. Thank you very much, Patricia, for that. I think you raised many questions in your document, but some of us who are not so learned understand now what is contained in the bill. Because sometimes the bill is not as easy as we think that it is easy, but when you make such a summary to some of us, it's very much understandable, better than the way you read it yourself, the bill itself. I really appreciate it. I will give then 10 minutes to members of parliament just to ask some few questions from yourself. You must just note down everything, and then you will respond, both of you, on this, after which you will take your presentation. But by 12 o'clock, I have another meeting to attend. I just want us to be finished by 12 o'clock. It's a pity that you started late. Maybe by now we have been dealing with the second presentation. Thank you. I'm expecting hands from members who would like to ask questions. Annelies?
Thanks, Jefferson. Yeah, I think, it sometimes it assists us when the research department looks critical at a bill. I mean, that's what we expect them to do as well, and it raises, we don't have to agree with everything, but at least it opens our minds to some of the issues that might be there. Now, I'm also just wanted to say that I think it's a valid point, and I think we must follow up on it specifically from SAP's side on what the implementation plan in terms of getting capacity is. I think we, as a committee, we need to know that before we pass the legislation as well. You will remember with human trafficking, we had to delay that process as well because of capacity problems in departments like Home Affairs. And I would just like to say that I think it would be good that if we can get SAPs to indicate to us how they're going to address specifically the issue of forensics. You know, it's like the issue of detectives. Deputy Minister raised it as well last week. And there's been solutions proposed even by SAP last year that of every 15,000 officers coming in, new police officers, that 3,000 will go to detectives. The fact of the matter is you don't make somebody a detective in 6 months' time. It's a skill that develops. And forensics, even in the private sector, there's a shortage. So we need to know how we are going to address this problem.
Ms. Johnson?
Yeah, thanks. Just to pick up on the first point Annelies made, just to say that last week we did hear from the department and they were given a chance to present their research. So I think it's only fair that we do give the parliamentary research unit a chance. If their research is factually incorrect, then surely the department will be given an adequate time to respond when we deliberate the book clause by clause. On a separate point, just the point that Ms. Whittle makes on the NDDSA not being an independent body and it being SAPS and the possibility there of a sort of a conflict or possible contamination. At the moment, SAPS themselves take blood samples, for example, in drunken driving cases. So I just want to know, what are the safeguards there, and is it possible for them to maybe sort of start thinking along the types of safeguards that we could put in this bill to try to address that risk?
Thank you very much. Do we have hands this side? Okay. Ms. Cohen?
Yeah, look, I don't want to be misunderstood. I think that there are some issues here that clearly we have already discussed and that are very useful to raise again, because those are issues that are going to occupy our attention. But my worry is this, Chair. As a research department, as
an adjunct to this committee. The research unit's job is to help us as members of parliament. In other words, if we get a bill about DNA, we want to know, what is DNA? What does that mean, actually? What is the substance of the stuff that we're passing? How does, you know, what are the potential pitfalls? For example, when somebody gives their DNA and then they want to extract this so-called acid, which is what DNA is, it's an acid, from your cells. What can go wrong? What if Maggie Sorcher gives a piece of her hair and they take it to the labs and things go wrong there, and then suddenly you're guilty of 5 different offenses? That's what we need to know, because that's stuff we don't know. We don't need to know that we should be looking at this aspect of the bill or that aspect of the bill, and because this is imbalanced. I don't think, with due respect, and with due respect to Ms. Whittle, because I do think that you did a good job in terms of summarizing the aspects of the bill, but I think we need to be careful about that. The reason is simply this, that there's a reason why you and I are elected members, and that is to take certain crucial decisions, and part of that is to raise issues of concern and to get ourselves informed of what it is that we're doing, so that we can actually pass the best legislation possible. Now, if you raise things like is being done in this research as to why is it that doctors in hospitals can make a call as to whether to take evidence or not, and say that this bill is therefore quite heavy-handed and giving medical practitioners more powers than we should. Then we need to say in the same breath that currently that is the situation, because then you're being dishonest about it. And it's not a question of us versus the department. That's not as I understand our role. Our role as part of the state, we're an arm of the state, is to try and we pass laws in the interest of the Commonwealth. In other words, what is good for everyone? You said it yourself in the last meeting. What is good for most of the people most of the time? Because you can't please everybody at the same time. And so that is the job that we have to fulfill, and theirs is to help us to fulfill that task. Now, on the one hand, if you want them to summarize and so on, clearly that's your prerogative. You want them to summarize the issues and so on. You as the chair, you can make that call. But you see, it still doesn't help me to ask the crucial questions. What can go wrong when somebody's DNA is being tested? Where should we, as legislatures, try and impact most on the things that we haven't heard about? The department has told us all about this bill, it's given us a briefing and so on and so on. But they won't know what is DNA, where can it go wrong, how can a scene be contaminated, how can we best, and I see that some of these issues have been captured here, but it's not new stuff. So all I'm saying, Comrade Chair, is that we need that kind of information as well. Even if we want to summarize the bill, that's fine. But let them also do comparative studies. Let's see what they do in other countries that's best practice. And let's see if we can learn from those things. Let's see which is the most renowned database in the world. Let's see how they've done it, and let's deal with that. On the issue of samples and DNA profiles, they're two different things, as I understand it. You take your piece of hair, that's your sample. But to get a profile, a DNA profile, which is that picture that you see on the other piece of research, that little picture, that genetic code, is what is going onto your database. So you're not going to keep your sample in the same place as the database. I was seeing you nodding, so that's how I was trying to explain this, because that's as I understand it, and that's how most countries do it. So if you go to a crime scene and you get a piece of cloth with a blood stain on it, that's a sample. But to get a profile, you have to do an analysis of it, and then you get that picture, right? That twirly-twirly picture. And that picture is kept in three dimensions on your computer database. But you don't keep that piece of cloth in the same place. So they're two different places. That's what it means. So Komitsha, I hope I've clarified my interventions earlier, because I do think, firstly, the research must be honest. Number two, if you do want the research department to summarize, then they must summarize. And they mustn't draw conclusions. And number three, for me, what would be really valuable is if they deal with the things that we don't know about, which is some of it is being dealt with in the other paper, which hopefully we're going to get now.
So is there any other hand? Because I want to give another chance. Okay, thank you very much, members of parliament. I will give you 5 minutes to respond on some of the direct questions that has been directed to yourself. And those political questions that has been raised, you don't have to. You are not politicians. Politicians will deal with that. And other questions that has been raised here, I think they have to do mostly with the drafters of this bill. When we meet with them, we'll ask them those questions. You only deal with those questions that you can deal with. Those you can't deal with, you leave them to us as politicians. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm only going to deal with the issue of safeguards, and I'm just actually going to request a member if we can just have a little bit of time to look into what are possible safeguards. When we talk about the member that asked about the independence of a database from SAPS and what are the possible safeguards that can be built or looked at where that is concerned. So we're just going to ask the committee if we can have some time to go back and look at that aspect. It's difficult to determine which question I should answer. But safe to say that we have a paper on comparative issues. For time's sake and not to belabor the committee, we skip some of the issues because I do have in the presentation there's a slide that deals with what the definitions are of DNA and DNA profile as was done in the Marper judgment. If I can just look at the slide of the presentation where that is. So it was merely for issue of time constraint. We didn't want to go into those details, but just concentrated on the main issues that we wanted to raise with the committee. Madam Chair, I just want to say that my intention is not to mislead the committee. And honestly, what I've presented to the committee is my interpretation of the bill. So everything that is in the bill is open to interpretation. My interpretation was that there was a shift of responsibility on the medical practitioner. And the department can then give their interpretation, and every member is free to have a different interpretation of, and that's all that I want to say on the matter.
Thank you very much. We'll take everybody who would like to make presentation to this committee. We'll accommodate them. But at the end, we are the ones that's going to take decision, whether you mislead us or not. But at the end, we are going to take decision on what is correct for the people of this country. I will then give to Ms. Isaacs to take us through his head presentation, after which then you follow the same trend, but try to be as short as possible. Talk to your document. And then we will then take questions for 10 minutes again, after which then we come to the end of the meeting. Over to you, Susie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to thank the committee for this opportunity to make this presentation. The paper that I'm presenting is called Criminal Law Amendment Comparative Analysis. Firstly, we all acknowledge the need for this piece of legislation, and we hope that this will enable us to improve our conviction rates as evidence-gathering techniques will be improved. The first point by way of introduction that I would like to make is on slide 3 of my presentation, the difference between DNA and fingerprints. It seems that often DNA profiles and fingerprints are being equated to the same thing. However, when you look at a fingerprint, whatever information is available on the fingerprint is visible to the naked eye, and All that is required is that two different fingerprint samples to be compared for the fingerprint expert to make a positive match. However, with regard to DNA, what is required is that a blood or tissue sample needs to be drawn and analyzed to determine what information that sample contains. Now, while technology is improving, we don't know the full extent of the information that is that is held in our DNA. At present, genetic information could be used in various ways, and the information that could be held in our DNA could tell us a lot of information that we may not necessarily want the state to have access to regarding, for example, addiction, our criminal tendencies, our sexual orientation. So while at this stage we don't know the full extent of DNA, the information contained in DNA. I'm now at slide 9, and I'm going to deal with the constitutional issues arising from the bill. Some of the rights that maybe we've identified as being affected by this legislation is the right to equality, human dignity, freedom and security of person, privacy, rights of children and arrested and detained and accused persons. Now, in our constitutional court and our court in general, always protect our rights, but however, there are instances in which violations are allowed, but the other party, and in this instance, the state needs to justify this violation in terms of the limitations clause. In terms of Section 9.1, dealing with differentiation between categories of persons, what needs to be proved is that while the state may differentiate between categories of persons, there must be a rational reason for this differentiation, and it must be linked to a legitimate government's purpose. With regard to human dignity is one of the rights that permeates every single right in the Constitution. And when the courts deal with every right, they have the question as to whether a person's dignity has been infringed. With regard to freedom and security of person, this is also a very important right, and it needs to be protected to ensure minimal state intrusion, except when absolutely necessary and justifiable. I'm at slide 13 regarding privacy. With regard to privacy, and this is one of the issues that, in terms of the bill, that may give rise to constitutional challenges, is in determining whether privacy has been infringed. The manner in which our constitutional court has looked at it is, firstly, there's a two-stage approach. The first is to question whether the right to privacy has been infringed in terms of our constitution. And in the manner in which they determine whether this right has been infringed is, firstly, the first part of the test is to determine whether the person subjectively had a legitimate expectation of privacy. So whether that individual expected their right to privacy to be protected. And the second leg of the test is to determine whether this expectation was objectively reasonable. In other words, would society believe that this right in this instance should be protected? So when dealing with the right to privacy, a balance needs to be struck between an individual's right to privacy and the state's right to have private information. With regard to the rights of children, the state has to ensure that the best interest of the child is protected. And there are also various international obligations that the state needs to adhere to. On slide 15, dealing with the rights of arrested persons, we all understand the need and the importance of these rights, and they are of paramount importance, especially when a person is accused, and their rights are already being curtailed as an accused person. So any infringement in this right must be absolutely necessary and justifiable. With regard to the manner in which our courts have dealt with some of these issues, our courts have allowed infringements or violations of rights of accused persons once the state has proved that the need for the violation justified it, and it far outweighed the person's right in the instance. So, for example, a court did order that a bullet be removed from a suspect's body. However, in another instance, the court felt that this was too far a violation and it was not justifiable. with regard to taking of blood, involuntary taking of blood samples from an accused person to compile a DNA profile for criminal proceedings, the courts have found that the rights of privacy, dignity, and bodily integrity were infringed. However, in terms of Section 37 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which allows for these infringements, the court found that Section 37 was a justifiable limitation in terms of the limitation clause. In another decision, the taking of fingerprints from an accused, the court held that this was not a violation of a person's right to dignity. And with regard to taking of a voice sample for the purposes of investigation, the courts have held that this is not a violation of the right to self-incrimination or the right to silence. So our courts are willing to accept instances where rights can be violated, but it must be shown that it serves a legitimate purpose and it's justifiable in terms of our limitations clause. So therefore, in passing this legislation, Parliament must ensure that a balance is struck in protecting the individual's right, while at the same time ensuring that we empower our police to have effective criminal investigation. I'm now at slide 19, and I'm going to highlight certain issues that we as a research unit have identified that may give rise to concern, and we hope that this will assist you in your deliberations. The manner in which I'm going to do this is I'm going to highlight the issue, and then I'm going to discuss the various approaches that other countries have taken, and then I'm going to highlight issues that the committee may consider in its deliberations. Slide 20 that deals with the retention of fingerprints and DNA profiles of convicted persons. This is specifically to convicted persons. As it stands, the bill proposes that both the fingerprints and non-intimate samples of all convicted persons be taken and the profiles be stored on the DNA database. Slide 22. The position in the United States is as follows. The United States has federal legislation governing DNA, as well as each of the 50 states has its own legislation and own procedures dealing with DNA. However, the Justice for All Act of 2004 allows for the DNA profiles of all offenders convicted of a federal crime to be uploaded on the DNA database. So there's a difference between a federal crime, that is, it's done at national level, and a state offense, which would be something within the state. So in terms of this act, the United States allows for the FBI to gather the DNA profiles of those who have are convicted of federal crimes. In terms of states, a total of 47 out of 50 states record the profiles of offenders convicted of felonies. Now, felonies, in terms of the USA, there's a difference between a felony and a misdemeanor. A felony is a far more serious offense which could result in imprisonment, while a misdemeanor is a less serious offense which is dealt with the equivalent of our magistrate's court or the local court, and the sentences are far lighter. So in 47 states allow offenders' DNA profiles to be stored for serious offenses. 34 states allow the profiles for certain misdemeanors, so for certain minor offenses, to be stored, while only 4 states allow for the DNA profiles for a larger list of minor offenses to be stored, and 49 states allow for the profiles of those who have been imprisoned or serving community sentences to be stored. Now, the constitutionality of retaining this information was challenged in the Ninth Circuit Court in the United States in the case of United States versus Kincaid, where the DNA Analysis Backlog Elimination Act allowed for the extraction of DNA from an individual in prison or on probation or parole, so as long as he had been convicted of a federal offense. So basically, this act was trying to
get rid of the backlog and allowed for people who are already in prison to force them to give the DNA samples. This act was challenged on the basis of it was a violation of the American Fourth Amendment, which is more or less equivalent to our rights to privacy. In deciding this matter, the court concluded that a person who commits a crime has a reduced expectancy of privacy, and the forcible extraction of blood was a minimum invasion. The government's interest in DNA profiling is monumental, and therefore searches on balancing the rights to privacy and the government's interest, the searches for DNA in terms of this act was constitutional. However, this approach has been criticized by many American commenters. Firstly, the notion that taking a blood sample is a minimal invasion of privacy is challenged because the information contained within the blood sample and the fact that it could be permanently stored in a government database means that the right is severely violated. Further, the government has a right in terms of this act in America to continuously retest. So the information that could be extracted at a later stage again will invade the right to privacy. Another challenge to the notion that convicted persons have a diminished expectation of privacy is that while they do have a diminished expectancy of privacy, their right to privacy still exists and must not be unnecessarily intruded on. Another point that is raised in terms of convicted offenders is that once an offender has paid the debt to society and has served the punishment, that offender is restored as a member of society. So what rights are there of the state to still continue holding information about them once they have paid their debt? Okay, with regard to the issues that, in terms of South Africa that arises on the bill, as I just said, that a convicted person's rights are violated already by the fact that they are incarcerated and they're kept away from society. But once they are released or the sentence is served, on what basis can our state justify keeping this information? The arguments in favor of the state keeping this information is that the convicted offender does not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in South Africa. The offender was aware that one of the consequences of being convicted was that his personal information would be retained by the state. Further, society expects the state to record information of this nature for future investigative purposes. Another reason as to why convicted offenders, why the violation may be justifiable in terms of convicted offenders is that many criminals recommit the same offense, and this information will enable the state to identify them more easily. Secondly, in theory, there's the deterrent effect of storing this information. The offender would know that the state will be easily able to identify them, so therefore it may prevent them from committing offenses of this nature. However, one of the issues that I would like to highlight is the storing of information regarding people who have committed minor offenses. So, for example, if a person is convicted of criminal inuria or possession of a small quantity of DACA or public disturbance, their information is going to be stored on the database. And in most instances, the chances of them reoffending are minimal. So is it justifiable in instances of minor offenses to retain the information of people by the state? I'm referring to slide 25 at the stage. I'm now dealing with specifically with the rights of arrested persons. The bill proposes that fingerprints and intimate samples be taken from all persons who are arrested, those who are on bail or released on warning, or those who have been summoned. With regard to the United States, the DNA Fingerprint Act authorizes federal authorities to obtain and permanently store DNA from all arrested persons. This is at a federal level. However, at state level, each state has its own
legislation governing arrested persons. As of November 2008, 14 out of 50 states include the DNA profiles of persons arrested for serious offenses. Of this group, 7 states include the DNA profiles of all persons arrested on felony crimes. So 7 out of 50 states keep information about all persons arrested for felony offenses. On slide 27, the position in the England and Wales is that the United Kingdom promotes compulsory DNA sampling upon arrest of a suspect for any recordable offence, regardless of whether that sample is relevant to the investigation. The position varies vastly from the one in the European Union. While the countries differ, there seems to be a general trend. In France, non-consensual sampling of suspects is completely prohibited. In Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Malta, police are able to take compulsory samples from individual suspects, but such sampling requires a judicial warrant. In Austria, only suspects in cases of severe crimes can be sampled. In Finland and Netherlands, sampling is limited to crimes which attack specific terms of imprisonment. So in Finland, a sample can be only taken when a person is arrested and the possibility of a sentence of 6 months is possible, and in the Netherlands where there's a possible sentence of 4 years. So as a result of such arrangements, it is usual that sampling will only be taken in relation to a specific offence in question, and there is very limited scope that allows automatic sampling. Now the position in Canada is also quite restrictive in comparison to what South Africa wishes to adopt and England at present. The Canadian code allows for the sampling of data of the designated classes of people, but certain criteria must be met. In order for the law enforcement official to obtain a sample from an arrested person, a DNA warrant must be applied for. And in the judicial officer making this determination must ensure that the protections of the Canadian Charter of Freedoms are met while ensuring that the government's, while taking into consideration government's law enforcement goals. The procedure to obtain a warrant is that a DNA warrant is obtained by sworn information presented to a court judge, who can then only grant a warrant upon reasonable grounds to believe that the designated offence has been committed, and that the bodily substance has been found in a place where the offence was committed, and that the person targeted by the warrant was party to the offence, and that the forensic DNA analysis of a bodily substance from that person will provide evidence about whether the bodily substance was from the person. So basically, Canada has very strict requirements before a DNA warrant is issued and before the police can take a sample from an accused person. Despite these strict requirements, this act was still challenged regarding the constitutionality of this. In the case of R versus SAV, on slide 29, the complainant in this matter was charged with a sexual assault of a 14-year-old girl. The complainant, the young girl, had an abortion and police took the fetal tissue for DNA testing. After obtaining a warrant, the police seized a blood sample from the accused and conducted a forensic analysis comparing his DNA to that of the fetuses to determine whether he was the father. It was found to be positive, and the accused was arrested and charged with sexual assault and sexual exploitation. He challenged this on his basis that his rights to privacy were violated. The court in this decision held that the issuing of a DNA warrant did not violate the accused's right to privacy. His right not to be self-incriminated was also not violated, and DNA warrants were therefore found to be constitutional. The constitutional issues arising from the South African proposed bill on slide 30, the need of the state to be able to conduct investigations must be balanced against the rights of an accused person. The state must be given sufficient leeway to gather evidence, including real evidence such as blood and fingerprint samples, to either prosecute the accused or exonerate him of the charges. The approach adopted by Canada is rigorous, while the approach by England is not very restrictive. South Africa tended to adopt an approach that's not restrictive. This means that even when persons are arrested for minor offences, they will also have to provide a sample. And the samples provided from them will be retained for a period of 5 years. Some of the issues that I would like to highlight is, how does the state justify obtaining samples from people arrested for minor offences, especially when the evidence obtained from the sample will not be used to prosecute them? And is this violation of their rights in this instance justifiable in terms of the Constitution? The next category of people that I would like to highlight is the retention of samples of people who are found not guilty or in instances where charges have been withdrawn. At present, Section 37(5) of the Criminal Procedure Act directs that fingerprints, palm prints, footprints, and photographs and records of the steps taken should be destroyed when a person is found not guilty after trial, when the conviction is overturned on appeal, the charges were discharged at a preparatory examination, and no criminal proceedings were instituted against an accused or the prosecutor declined to prosecute. The bill proposes that all these samples will be retained, and the information derived from such samples will only be destroyed after a period of 5 years if that person was not convicted in a court of law. On slide 32, the position in the United States is highlighted. The United States allows for instances where a person can apply to the database to have their information removed. For example, at federal level, a person can apply to the FBI for their records, the records of their DNA profiles to be expunged from the national database. This can be done when their convictions have been overturned on appeal, the charges against them have been dismissed, they have been acquitted, or no charge has been filed for the applicable period. At state level, 38 states allow for expungement of records as determined by their specific statutes. A person applying for expungement must not have been convicted of another offense. In 38 states, the detail expungement procedure, 33 requires the offender to initiate the process. So basically, in 33 states, the offender must make an application to have his records expunged. The position in England and Wales on slide 33, the United Kingdom is the only member of the state of the EU that expressly permits the systematic and indefinite retention of DNA profiles of acquitted persons or persons where charges were withdrawn. This was not the position previously, but the Criminal Justice and Police Act was amended to allow for this. At present, intimate samples can be taken without consent of an individual arrested for a recordable offense and detained in a police station. DNA samples and profiles may be retained and held on the database for comparison with other profiles from individuals and crime scenes, even if the person is cleared of the offense or is not prosecuted. Samples taken from volunteers may be loaded onto the database with written consent. Now, these provisions have been challenged both in the House of Lords and then lately in the European Court of Human Rights. In the matter of the House of Lords, the Marpia decision, a Lord Steyn contended that the mere retention of fingerprints and DNA samples in a manner provided in the legislation did not constitute an interference with the right to respect of private life. But if it did, the interference was minor and the purpose of retention, which is the prevention of crime and the protection of others to be free of crime, were provided for by law. Ultimately, it was in the public interest to fight crime for the police to have a large database as possible, and therefore retention presents a measured and proportionate reason to legislate aiming and dealing at crime. So the Lord Steyn in this decision found that the rights of society as a whole outweigh the individual's rights in this instance, and it was therefore important that the state maintain a large database of DNA profiles in order to assist them in their fights against crime. However, in a minority decision, Baroness Hale made this comment, quoting the Canadian Privacy Commissioner, "No surveillance technology is more threatening to privacy than that designed to unlock the information contained in the human genes." The Mabe decision was challenged in the European Court of Human Rights, where the court considers the matter in terms of the European Convention of Human Rights. The court was of the view that protection of personal data is of fundamental importance to the individual's enjoyment of his private and family life. The court overturned this decision and found that it was struck by the blanket and indiscriminate nature of the power of retention in England and Wales. The material may be retained irrespective of the nature and the gravity of the offence for which individuals were suspected. This has not only failed to strike a fair balance between competing public and private interests, but it also constitutes a disproportionate interference with the applicant's right to a private life and cannot be considered as necessary in a democratic society. So the EU court found that a balance was not being struck in this legislation, and the individual rights were being violated in this instance. With regard to the position in EU states with regard with retaining arrested person samples, on slide 35, the current position in Scotland as part of the United Kingdom is significant. In Scotland, the DNA samples and resulting profiles must be destroyed if the individual is not convicted, if the individual is not convicted or is granted an absolute discharge. Recently, there was an amendment to this, and which allowed for biological samples and profiles to be retained for 3 years if the person arrested was suspected of a certain sexual and violent offences, even if that person was not convicted. So they did extend the legislation to allow profiles of arrested people to be retained when the offence in question was of a sexual or violent nature. However, after the 3-year period expired, if the police still require the sample to be retained, they need to make an application to the sheriff for further extension. With regard to other EU countries, most countries in the EU have established DNA data bases that require their custodians to destroy the DNA profiles and samples from the individuals who have been discharged either prior to prosecution or by the courts. In Austria, Belgium, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Slovakia, Slovenia, Sweden, and the Netherlands, there is no retention or use of DNA from those not convicted of an offence. In these countries, any retention or subsequent use of DNA profiles followed by a pushover is illegal. So those countries do not allow this information to be retained. In fact, it's illegal to retain this information. In Finland requires destruction of a suspect's profile within 1 year of a criminal acquittal and permits the retention of suspect's profile for 10 years if the suspect is deceased. Germany allows the retention of some suspect's profiles by the police in cases where the individual is suspected of a serious crime, especially one that is of sexual or homicidal in nature, or where they have previous criminal records for serious crimes. Canada, again, adopts a very restrictive approach on slide 36. Retaining these profiles is prohibited in terms of the Canadian Code, which states that both the bodily substances and the results shall be destroyed without delay if the results were negative, if the person is acquitted of the offence, or after an expiry of 1 year, that person is discharged from the hearing, the charges are withdrawn, or the prosecution is stayed. If there is a reason to retain the information, then this must be made. An application must be made to court for this information to be retained. Slide 38. The constitutional issues arising from the South African Bill. The bill does not allow for immediate expungement of records from the national database. The bill directs that records of arrested persons will only be destroyed after 5 years if the person is not convicted in another offense. Further, there's no automatic expungement of in cases of minors whose parents consented to them to be included on the volunteer index. They would have to make an application for this to be done. The idea of not having expungement automatic or some sort of expungement proceeding is not in keeping with international trends. The right to privacy may be legitimately limited when the accused is subject to having when the accused is a part of criminal investigations. However, what is the justification for keeping the information of a person who has been acquitted or charges have not been proceeded against them? Therefore, the state needs to have a reasonable justification to retain information in these instances. With regard to the issue of children, the bill does not differentiate between persons or includes children with regard to persons, and the only instance, again, where children can apply for their records to be expunged is when it was included by their parents on the national on a volunteer index. In terms of the United States, 32 states allow for the profiles of juvenile convicts to be stored. The position in terms of the European Union, the European Court of Human Rights in the Marpe case expressed particular concern at the policy of retaining the bio information of minors, having regard to the requirements of the UN Convention of the Child. The court pointed out the danger of giving parents the power to consent on the children's behalf for forensic analysis. The issue that the committee must consider, as Ms. Whittle highlighted, is whether the bill is consistent with the aim and objectives of the Child Justice Act. On slide 41, I just highlight the different DNA data banks and how different jurisdictions deal with it. In South Africa, the bill proposes to establish a national DNA database, which will have various indexes. In the United States, the national DNA data system is made up of various local and state databases which input information into the national database. In Canada, on slide 42, they have a national DNA database which again inputs information, and the right to input information to the DNA database was challenged in a Canadian case of R versus Rogers, where the court held that the collection of DNA samples for DNA bank purposes for designated convicted persons was reasonable within the Canadian Charter. Society's interest to using powerful technology to assist law enforcement agencies in the identification of offenders is beyond dispute. The result impact on the physical integrity of the targeted offender is minimal. So on the balancing approach, the court held that storing information on a DNA database is while it's a restriction or violation of rights, it's justifiable in society. Another issue that has been highlighted is foreign access to DNA profiles. In South Africa, the Act allows in certain instances for foreign states to have access to DNA profiles. The position in the United States, we have not been able to get concrete information on them, but it seems that they are entering into various agreements with other states to allow for this to happen. In England, the UK Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights has expressed concern about foreign investigators using the national DNA database for fishing expeditions and the data protection issues which it raises. A report was commissioned and recommended that there should be safeguards in place to protect sensitive information on the UK DNA database from being shared with other countries. While close cooperation with other states is necessary to solve other crimes, it's important that there should be some level of protection for the national. The EU, the European Union on slide 44, has enacted very stringent privacy regulations regarding data protection. There's guidelines for sharing information regarding across borders, and there must be adequate protection for the individual as well as the state. So in considering the South African proposal, we must identify whether there is sufficient safeguards with regard to sharing information with foreign states. Which brings me to my conclusion on slide 45. It says, all new breakthrough technologies either elevated to answer all the problems or is reviled by prophets of doom. DNA profiling is no exception. It has both benefits to assist law enforcers. On the other hand, civil liberty advocates are very wary of this technology. In passing this legislation, a balance needs to be struck in ensuring that both sides of the debate, a balance is struck between both sides of the debate, as this legislation has the ability to be of great assistance to the police. Thank you.
Thank you very much, you are Sue Ann, Isaac. Thanks very much. Members, that's the presentation from Ms. Isaac, as far as her research is concerned. Some of the issues that you mentioned here, I sometimes felt as if you were seated with one person who sent me his presentation that he would like to come and make in front of the committee. Most of the issues that you raised, he raised those issues. I didn't, Professor, but I do have that presentation. I will then open for questions from members of parliament. And I'm sure each and every one of us has got that judgment, so that we should go through these things before we receive submissions from other interested parties who feel like coming and make presentation to the committee. Ms. Cohen, I've noticed you. After you, Ms. Van Wyk. Yeah. Okay.
No, thank you very much. There are just a few questions. Just generally, I think that this has been an enormously helpful input. I certainly struggle with some of the technical issues myself, so it does help to understand a little bit about what DNA can provide insight into, and I think that particularly on slide 7 that assists somewhat. But perhaps I could start there and ask, I read somewhere some time ago about again this last issue that you point out about civil rights groups having concerns. It seems to me that it's more concerns to deal with what might possibly be able to be, with the improvement of technology into the future. What insights might be had into DNA samples and DNA profiles and so on, rather than an actual real concern on the current technology. Would you agree with that in terms of your research, and particularly this issue of race stroke ethnic identification on DNA samples? In your reading, I tried to find out whether it was possible, inter alia, with all of these other things that you say can be gleaned into from your DNA sample, whether in fact the issue of race and ethnicity hasn't come up, because I know in some countries, may not be ours, but in some countries that does pose some kind of problem, particularly in terms of racial profiling, etc. On this issue of foreign access, for me it just seems to me that this would fall or become part of the cooperation agreements that we do sign with other countries. So in other words, if we agree with country X that we're going to cooperate in criminal investigations with them, then this becomes part of that procedure of cooperation. So that becomes on all fours with public international law. So I'm not quite sure that I understand what the big concerns are there, and perhaps if you want to elaborate on that. Then, just in terms of the actual document, I see that while I think it's correct that you raise all of the possibilities around the rights in the Constitution that I wouldn't say are violated, but certainly that give rise to some kind of consideration that we need to be careful about. I see that you don't deal at all with the limitations clause, and I think that that's a big issue. And I think that, particularly when you're doing research, that certainly there needs to be some kind of comprehensive and holistic view of the Bill of Rights, taking into account the limitations clause as well, and what the courts would consider to be appropriate and inappropriate limitations under the circumstances. I would like to know, while a lot of this data, particularly the comparative studies, deal with the issue of retention of data, so even after a case has been completed, whether the person's acquitted or not acquitted, the issue that you raise quite starkly is, if I could paraphrase what you're saying, so what is the state's justification for retaining that data, legally speaking, constitutionally speaking? But am I correct to say that, firstly, let me ask you, what exactly, which rights is being infringed by retaining of that data, particularly if it's a database? In other words, it's not a punishment, it's not a sanction, it's not a sentence, it's a database. Just as you have a national population register, which has your fingerprints, by the way, it's a database. So firstly, what is the argument legally to say what is the justification? In other words, there must be a right that you're protecting in order to ask for justification. The second issue is, am I correct to say that although in your comparative study you don't say it at all, but as I understand it, both Britain and 48 states in the United States allow retention of data indefinitely. And in 50 states in the United States, they allow indefinite retention of data of people who have been charged with violent or sexual crimes. So I think that's quite an important statistic to have in the comparative study. What I would like, though, is because I think a lot of the stuff was extracted from other material, would it not be possible for us to have some of your principal documents in terms of research so that we can look at, you know, the stuff that we want to find and so on as well? Your Kincaid case is the other one that I would like to have a copy of so that we can have a look at that judgment in full. I know that you tried to summarize for us and so on, but it might be very useful to have a look at that case. The South African cases that you allude to, the bullets in people's bodies and so on, I'm not sure what the ranks of those courts are where those judgments have been given, so exactly which one stands and which one is the latest decisions and so on, so if we could get those as well. And lastly, Chair, with the Smarty case, the European Convention is very specific in regard to privacy. And clearly, when that court took that decision to overturn the British case, there would have been some acknowledgement of the European Convention and that clause that stands in that convention, which is very specific, which, by the way, we are not a party to. But I just would like to see that clause in the European Convention that the court used to overturn it, because I'd like to compare that with what we have in our legislation, and if you've already done a comparative on those aspects. In other words, what the European Convention provides in terms of privacy and what our law provides in terms of privacy, so we can see what the difference is. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Van Wyk.
Two short questions, Chairperson. Just the first one on the issue of abuse of DNA, where it is kept. Have you come across any examples in other countries where it actually was abused, with other words, planted, etc., and, you know, to what extent does it happen? Second question, in your research, do you come across countries similar to South Africa with the situation where we are currently in, where the forensic unit is part of the SAPS, did you come across countries where it's also not outside of the police, and what are they doing in order to safeguard the abuse of that?
Is there any other questions? Because I'm closing this session of questions. All right. Then I will give over to you to respond to some of those questions, and then where members ask for material from yourself, I think you'll have to liaise directly with yourself to get that assistance. Okay, over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With regard to members' question regarding civil rights groups and their concerns, yes, it seems, especially in the United States, there's concern about the idea of state intrusion into the domain of the person. Lots of groups such as the ACLU oppose any further state interference into the personal life. But I think one of the major concerns regarding DNA is the fact that the potential of the information that it holds. And as technology has been developed, it's been used in different instances. For example, the idea of using DNA to identify family members, and it has been used to convict persons by identifying, using the DNA from their family members to identify the accused. So there's those questions that are arising, and I think it's regarding ethics and people's, you know, right to privacy. And I think the fundamental issue is, should the state have this information regarding you? You know, are people comfortable with them holding this information, especially when they were not convicted persons? With regard to race and ethnic identification, I did not look extensively into this issue, but it has been one of the issues flagged as to the potential of DNA to have ethnic identification, where certain groups, so if a DNA sample is found, then they will target certain groups and saying the accused is belonging to this particular ethnicity or race. So when they do a search, then they will maybe limit it in that instance when they are investigating. With regard to the issue of foreign access, I think we just wanted to highlight that, you know, there needs to be adequate safeguards, and obviously if there's agreements between other states, those should be incorporated into that, just basically to highlight the issue. With regard to a limitations clause, yes, I did not go extensively into the limitations clause analysis. I just wanted to highlight the issues that had arisen. But obviously when deciding the cases, the court will have regard to the limitations clause, and there's a manner in which rights can be limited in terms of a law of general application and so forth. So our courts will have to apply the limitations clause to each and every right, and the manner it's been limited before it finds that the limitation is justifiable. With regard to the question as to what is the issue, the rights regarding storing of DNA, I think the biggest issue is regarding privacy, and as I said, whether we would, as individuals, want the state to have access to information which we ourselves do not know about ourselves. So that is a major concern, and I guess there's also the issue of dignity in respect to people who have been found not guilty, having their information retained on a database where they would be subjected to more searches, although the fact that they are no different from another ordinary citizen who has the same rights as them. With regard to the question of abuse of DNA, I think in the research in general, we did come across instances where DNA has been planted, but we haven't looked at that issue extensively, and I think we will, regarding safeguards and the abuse of DNA, we will also look at that. With regard to the independence of the forensic unit, there's also an issue that we haven't looked into, so we will probably have a look into that and get back to you on that regard.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ms. Isaac. I think we've come to the end of the meeting, and this was an eye-opener to some of us. We have so much to read, and it helps a lot to get such presentation from yourself to assist us in issues that we don't understand in the bill. And maybe I should inform the actual committee that those who will be leaving for the forensic lab in Pretoria this evening will depart from Poor Days. At which time, Jeremy? From Poor Days. And then while Jeremy is thinking, we have then advertised for the people's opinion. I believe that We did get some from the department that I went through, and although they did not indicate that they would like to come and make a submission or presentation to the committee, we have decided that we'll wait and see what comes in during this week. And then next week then we'll select those that we think that we might invite to come and make presentation. I
But next week, we did receive a list of some few people, that organizations and individuals that indicated that they would like to come and make submissions. But since next week we don't have anything because we are still waiting for the submissions, then on Tuesday the 3rd, we'll sit for the whole day in order for us not to sit on Wednesday and Thursday in preparation for the State of the Nation on Friday. Because some of us will have families around Cape Town and all those things, so we don't want to keep you here. So we'll sit on the 3rd almost for the whole day, try to accommodate some of these people that we invited to come and make a submission, a presentation on Tuesday morning. We'll get the venue during the week, and also the names of the organizations that will be coming next week for the hearings. Yeah, for the hearings. So far, I did get a list from the department. And I also then spoke to some of the people that called me, and but most of the people were just saying that they sent in written submissions instead of coming in. As you are aware that the time is very short for us then to tell people to be in Cape Town by next week. It's not everyone who's got this, who's lucky and have tickets ready to come to Cape Town. They cost money. So I think we've come to the end of this meeting, and I would like to thank you guys very much, very much, from the bottom of my heart. Thank you very much for this. Thanks, Sissy over there. What's her name again? Nadia. Thank you very much for the research work. We'll go through everything, and then we'll also interact with yourselves outside this meeting about issues that won't be understanding. Then we meet then next week on Tuesday. Then we will communicate through to yourself about the venue. Thank you very much. Those who are going to Pretoria, we'll meet in Pretoria.